During Memorial Day at Lowe's, shop household must-haves for less. Save $80 on a Charbroil Performance Series 4-Burner Grill to chef up something special. Plus, get up to 45% off select major appliances to keep things fresh. Our best lineup is here at Lowe's. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 5/27 while supplies last. Selection varies by location. See Lowe's.com for details.
Visit your nearby Lowe's on Silver Drive in Columbus.
Hey guys, it's Ryan. I want to tell you about my new pastime, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has been around for over a decade, delivering the most fun you can have online. Play social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Truth and Justice. Thank you for joining us today. In this week's episode of Justice Warriors, I've got someone that's relatively new to the true crime scene and certainly to the audio podcast realm. He's no stranger to true crime, though. He does have a book out. This is going to be an interesting one. I think this is the quickest I've ever had to prepare for an interview. I had other interviews booked for this week, and I had some scheduling conflicts, went through my emails, and Emilio had sent me an email. So I reached out to him, found out his podcast is premiering today. It was, about 24 hours ago I reached out to you,
right.
Emilio?
Yeah.
And so now today we're recording this. You guys are hearing it on Sunday. We're recording this on Monday. Emilio's new podcast, Framed, the Kit Martin story, just premiered today. All 5 episodes of the series are out today. I've been binging it all day long. And so I'm going to be kind of catching up on the fly. I have been through almost all of the podcast, but first and foremost, I want to welcome Mr. Emilio Corsetti. Emilio, thanks for joining me.
Well, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
And wow, great work you've done on the show. When I started listening, the first thing I loved about it is from being an independent content creator, the raw, bare bones investigative work that you put into the podcast, which I want to get into in a minute. But before we do that, I want to talk a little bit about your book, because I have not had time to read your book, but this all came from a book that you wrote. And as I'm saying that, I feel like we should step back a little bit even before that, because you, much like me and many people in this space, didn't come from the audio production world or the video production world or even the investigative world. You were actually an airline captain prior to this. So
right.
Talk to me a little bit about that career and how you got from flying airplanes to making true crime podcasts.
I wouldn't consider myself a true crime podcaster or even a true crime writer. I just write books. I write nonfiction narratives is what I do.
Mm-hmm.
And prior to this most recent book, I wrote the book. Well, I had 2 aviation books. One was about, in fact, I wrote one book called 35 Miles from Shore, which is about an airliner that ran out of fuel and ditched in the Caribbean Sea. And it happened in 1970, and interestingly enough, it happened 56 years ago this week. They went into the Caribbean on May 2nd, 1970, and of course, 2 days later, May 4th, which is today, you had the Kent State shootings. So That story kind of got buried because of the publicity that the Kent State 4 shootings took. And I wrote a book about that. And then about 8 years later, I wrote another aviation book about an airline crew that was falsely blamed for causing a near-fatal crash. And then as I was working as a pilot for American Airlines, I heard this story about this pilot being arrested at the Louisville airport. And obviously, that caught my attention right away. Here's a pilot.
I didn't even think about the connection to aviation in this. I was so caught up in the facts of the case. Yeah, that I forgot that he was a pilot.
Yeah, he was a pilot. And not only was he a pilot, he was arrested at the airport prior to boarding a flight where he was going to go to work. So as a first officer. Now, he was employed by a regional airline. You know, they kind of sold it as he was with American Airlines, but in reality, it was an American Airlines subsidiary. So it was a PSA Airlines. But in any case, it caught my attention. And I just filed it away and went on about my business. And I was getting close to retiring. It's a 65 and out, the airlines. And then I heard that he was convicted of murder for all three of his neighbors. So that really caught my attention. I mean, why mm-hmm. would somebody with such a promising career throw it all away? So I started to dig a little bit further. There's a Dateline episode called The Evil That Watches. I watched that two or three times. And then that convinced me to go ahead and watch the entire trial because the trial was covered on Court TV. And as a result of that, I knew there was more to the story. I contacted Kit in prison right away. I was just blown away that nobody else had already picked up on this because to me, it was so obvious that there were problems with this entire case. So that became my project going into my last year at American and then into retirement.
So were you writing the books? Was just a hobby you had kind of while you were still flying planes? Like, how did you get into it? Had you always been an aspiring writer?
No, I've been writing for 20 plus years. I used to write for magazines, aviation magazines.
Mm-hmm.
And I really didn't like that because it was all tied around advertising. You know, like this aircraft manufacturer has a new product coming out. We want you to do a review on this product. Okay, I'll do that. But it didn't interest me. What interested me was real life stories, true stories. And I've always been interested in wrongful convictions. In fact, I have a website. It's called everythingnonfiction.com, and I cover wrongful convictions. So I reached out to you because that seems to be the focus of your podcast.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And what a great, the timing was impeccable as I started listening through. And I could see why on its surface, you know, you did an incredibly in-depth job of parsing through all the details and facts of the case. I could see why, how someone who just looked at kind of the bullet points from the prosecution, probably what was out in the, you know, the news articles when this put out, why they would just think, oh, well, this is another guilty guy. I mean, because it's presented as though there was just like all this overwhelming evidence against him.
I mean, that is a great point. And I make this argument, at least in the press materials, that this is a case for having cameras in the courtroom, right?
Yeah.
If you didn't have cameras to catch what went on, everybody would just accept the guilty verdict and move on. But when you see what happened in the courtroom, it changes the entire picture.
Well, let's start out with having you kind of give us the basic facts of the crime itself before we get into the trial. So we're talking about a triple homicide happened in Kentucky, right, in 2015?
November 18, 2015. It was 2 weeks before a scheduled court-martial for the defendant, Christian Martin. And one of the people that was going to testify for the JAG prosecutors was his neighbor, Calvin Phillips. So that's the reason. Well, first let's talk about the crime. So the crime involved three murders that occurred at different parts of the day, time of the day. Calvin Phillips was murdered sometime between 6:30 a.m. and 10:30 a.m., a four-hour window. Kit, that's his nickname, was home. He lived across the street, catty-cornered, right across the street. He was home from about, home alone, I should say, from about 7 to 9. So let's say a two-hour window. So he had a two-hour window where he could have gone across the street and killed the neighbor, preventing him from testifying in this court-martial trial. But he has security camera footage that caught everything. So we know his movements. The podcast gets into it a little bit more detail. So he's murdered sometime between in that four-hour window. And then later in the day, around 5:30 p.m., his wife comes home. She's on the phone with a family friend. And the wife says, oh, wait a second, I see something. Because she was trying to get a hold of her husband because there was delivery of this washing machine that they were expecting. And the family friend heard a scream, a startled sound, and then silence. So she was murdered sometime between, right around 5:30 p.m. So at 5:30 p.m. on November 18, it's pretty much dark. And the neighbor right next door, who was on the lookout for Pam's husband, Pam Phillips was the wife, he saw something that alarmed him enough that he grabbed a pistol in his phone and he ran over to the neighbor's house, and then he was shot and killed. So now you have three people that are been murdered. And then the crime continues because the body of Calvin Phillips is dumped down into a basement cellar. And then the bodies of Pam Phillips and Ed Danzero are taken to a farm field and set on fire. And the vehicle is set on fire and not discovered till the next day. And the next day would be November 19, 2015.
And one thing I missed in my mental notes while I was listening to all this at the gym today, what time was, so I know Pam, we know she was killed right around 5:30 because she was on the phone when it happened. Right. And we have the window for Calvin. The neighbor, do we have what was the time frame for when the neighbor went to investigate with the gun?
So the neighbor was Ed Danzero, who lived, they shared the same driveway across from Pam and Calvin Phillips. He was gone for most of the day. I'm not exactly sure, it's in the book, what time he got home. Let's say he got home around 3:30, 4 o'clock. At some point, Pam had called him and said she'd been trying to get a hold of her husband and asked him if he would go out in the backyard and look for him because maybe he fell or something in the backyard. So it's possible that the neighbor was killed before Pam got home at 5:30. But that wouldn't make any sense. Well, it could make sense if he saw something that alarmed, something obviously alarmed him. You wouldn't go look for your neighbor and take a pistol with you, right?
Right.
So something caught his attention that alarmed him enough that he had to grab a pistol and his cell phone. Now, there was a wooden privacy fence between the two driveways. And as he rounded their wooden privacy fence, he was shot. There's blood and he dropped his cell phone. There's blood there in the cell phone. But he wasn't killed because he continued on 60 yards into the backyard where he was shot again. And that's where the pistol was found along with another blood spot. So, it's possible that he was killed before Pam got home at 5:30. It's more likely that he was killed after Pam was killed because he saw or heard something that alarmed him.
Yeah, I'm thinking, you know, if it was before, then it's still daylight and, you know, he's grabbing a gun and there's shooting happening, you know, right out in the front yard.
It right would make next sense to Main Street. The Main Street in Pembroke goes right between all of these houses.
Yeah, it makes sense to me that maybe he heard a gunshot or something, and that's when he went over.
You know, the strange thing is this family friend, Marlene LaRocque, was on the phone, and where Pam Phillips was killed was right around the corner into the kitchen, and how she didn't hear, and there were multiple gunshots with the .22. How she didn't hear that, I don't have any explanation for.
Yeah, I was curious about that too. And then there was some mention of it. It might get, again, I'm halfway through episode 4, so it might get brought up or I might have missed it along the way. But there was a part in the, and I was watching and listening on YouTube, which by the way is the podcast, it's called Framed. Is it the Kit Martin story?
Right.
It's available on Spotify now in audio. By the time you hear this, it should probably be on Apple and all the other places.
Right.
But it's all available right now on YouTube, and I recommend YouTube either way, even if it's available on audio, because there's a big visual element to this. It's more of a short form documentary than it is, or long form documentary series than it is a podcast, I think, the way I was taking it.
That's the way I'm trying to sell it. I mean, that I agree with you. I mean, it's more documentary than it is podcast.
Yeah. But there was mention of, and it wasn't a time when I could look at my phone when we were talking about the firearms analysis, there's a picture where there's a gun next to the phone in the living room. Did I hear that right?
In the living room?
Or the kitchen, wherever it was.
Okay, so you're talking about Ed Danzero's pistol, right? It was an old World War II pistol that his dad had given him. What you're probably referring to is the gun holster. When the police went to investigate what happened to the neighbor, they found his holster in his chair. The pistol was actually found in the backyard next to a blood spot,
okay.
A blood stain in the yard.
That makes sense. So kind of how this tracks out, you have in the morning time, you got that 4-hour window where Calvin is killed. And then we know at 5:30, his wife comes home, she's killed. And then the neighbor at some point had gone to investigate with a gun, shot in the front yard, shot in the backyard. Then, like you said, Calvin is, his body is put into the basement or in the cellar. And then the other two are put into, it was Pam's car, right? That they took out to the field.
Yes.
Yeah. And it looks like it got stuck in the mud, like they couldn't drive it any further. And then they lit it on fire.
So they drove it out to the farm field around 1:30, 1:40 a.m. It's 1:40 a.m. There's no street lights. I mean, this is out in the middle of a farm field, basically. It's a gravel road, and the gravel road had a bend in it. And whoever was driving the car missed that turn, and they went straight ahead where there was some water collected. It had rained all day the day before, and it just got stuck in the mud. So that's where they decided that they were going to set the car on fire.
DraftKings Casino changed the game with exclusive flex spins. Now you can choose how to use your spins across more than 100 different slots. New casino players pay $5 and get 1,500 flex spins. Claim 50 spins a day for 30 days. Then you choose how to play across your favorite games. Download the app now and sign up with code TRUTH to claim 1,500 flex spins on your choice of slots. The crown is yours. In partnership with DraftKings Casino, gamble responsibly. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. In Connecticut, help is available for problem gambling. Call 888-789-7777 or ccpg.org. Please play responsibly. 21 plus. Physically present in Connecticut, Michigan, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, West Virginia only. Void in Ontario. Eligibility restrictions apply. Non-withdrawable spins issued as 50 spins per day for 30 days. Valid for select games only and expire each day after 24 hours. See terms at casino.draftkings.com/promos. Ends May 10th at 11:59 p.m. Eastern Time. Mental health care is one of the things that everybody says matters, but when someone actually tries to get help, the process can be way harder than it should be. Finding the right therapist can already feel overwhelming. Then you add in insurance, cost, availability, and trying to figure out who is actually a good fit, and it becomes one more stressful thing on top of the stress you are already dealing with. And that's why I like what Rula is doing. Rula is a healthcare company that helps connect people with licensed mental health providers who are in-network and accepting new patients. They partner with over 100 insurance plans, and Rula patients typically pay around $15 per session when using insurance. Depending on your benefits, your copay could even be as low as $0. And this isn't just about finding the first available person. Rula considers your goals, preferences, background, and state requirements to help provide a curated list of licensed therapists who are actually aligned with what you need. They also support care beyond therapy, including medication management when appropriate. For me, the biggest thing is this. We use insurance for our physical health all the time. Mental health should not be treated like some separate luxury that only some people can afford. Thousands of people are already using Rula to get affordable, high-quality therapy that's actually covered by insurance. Visit Rula.com/justice to get started. That's RULA.com/justice. One more time, visit Rula.com/justice to get started. That's RULA.com/justice. You deserve mental health care that works with you, not against your budget.
Lots of places can accidentally expose you to identity theft. Doctor's offices, online retailers, insurance companies, the list goes on. Thankfully, LifeLock monitors hundreds of millions of data points a second for threats to your identity, which is way more than anyone can do on their own. LifeLock keeps an eye on your personal information, credit applications, finances, and more. And if they find anything suspicious, like new loans or changes to your financial accounts, they alert you right away. All through text, phone, email, or the LifeLock app. Even better, alerts are automatically activated the moment you become a LifeLock member. No extra work on your part. Get the alerts that could make all the difference. Don't wait. Join LifeLock now. Visit LifeLock.com/iHeart and save up to 30% your first year. That's LifeLock.com/iHeart for 30% off. Terms apply.
Hey, it's Cole Swindell. After I give everything I've got to land a perfect vocal, I usually take 5 before jumping into the next track. And I've learned exactly how to recharge in that time. Some folks grab coffee. I hit a quick good luck spin. Next thing you know, the break is just as fun as laying down the track. A better break makes for a better take. Need a break? Let's chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus TNCs apply. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
And I say they, the prosecution, prosecuted successfully and convicted Kit of this crime. But as you will see, if you watch the podcast, everything points to there being more than one individual involved. In fact, let's see, I don't know if it's in episode 4, it's more likely in episode 5, that I think it is in episode 5, the prosecution admits to the judge that there's circumstantial evidence that more than one person was involved. Yet they never tied him to anybody else, and they still continued on with the trial.
Yeah, and we've seen, in my work, we've seen so many cases like that where, in order to convict person A, they have to concoct some weird theory that involves multiple people, but then they never go after persons B or C. It's like they say there was another person, but they never investigate it. But one of the questions I had in that regards was, what was the distance between where that car was found in Kit's house?
The distance between the house, Calvin Phillips's house, where Pam's car was moved to the farm field is approximately 4 miles. So it would have only taken them a little over 5 minutes at most to get from the house to the farm field and get stuck in the mud. So we know that there was a neighbor that was awakened by his dog barking at around 1:50 a.m. And the residents of that house, which overlooked that farm field, they eventually got up, and around 2 a.m., he looked out his window and he saw flames. But it's 2 a.m. His neighbor had a authority to burn stuff in his burn pile, mm-hmm. although it didn't line up to where he was seeing the flames. But he just went back to bed. And so we know that the car was set on fire around approximately 1:50 a.m. because the noise that these people made in setting this car on fire and the discussions they went between them woke up this dog, and this dog was barking like crazy and woke up these people. So that gives us the timeline of when this car was set on fire.
And the reason I was asking really was, I've heard through the podcast, the testimony from Kit's family about him, never leaving the house, being home. I've heard the prosecution's kind of theory about, how he's, setting the alarm and stuff, which we'll get into in a minute. But my thing is, either he walked 4 miles back home, had to have been covered in mud and stinking of kerosene and fire and everything else all the way back, or there would have had to been another vehicle there to follow him and drive him back.
You bring up an excellent point, and it's something that you basically do have to watch all 5 episodes to get the whole story, right? But here's what happened. Not only was Pam's car moved and taken to the farm field, but the neighbor's car was also moved. So when they were looking for the neighbor, they knew he was home because he was preparing dinner. The door was open, the TV was on, but his car was missing. And Pam's car was missing. So they identified Pam's car after the next day when they found it burned in this farm field. But when they went to the neighbors at Dan's Row, his car was missing. They ended up finding it in a gravel parking lot that was in between the house and the farm field. So it was 4 blocks away. So the prosecution had to come up with why would he even move 2 vehicles, right?
Right. So
it doesn't make sense that he would drive. What you just said is exactly the prosecution's implausible theory. He takes Pam's car, he drives it to the farm field, gets stuck in the mud, he sets it on fire. He obviously has to carry whatever kerosene container he has with him back.
Oh, because I forgot about that too. Yeah, because that wasn't found out there.
Right. So he walks the 4 miles back to the crime scene. Then he, for some unknown reason, well, no, they have a reason. For some reason, he gets into the neighbor's car, and then he drives to his ex-wife's house where he throws the victim's phone into her front yard. And then he drives back from that, and he parks the car. Instead of parking it back in the neighbor's home, he parks it in this gravel parking lot, and then he walks home. It's implausible. It's impossible based on phone location data evidence. It makes no sense. There were more than one person involved. What happened was one person drove the vehicle with two bodies in it to the farm field. The other person followed in Ed Danzerow's car. You'll see it in episode 5. The one car got stuck in the mud. They used the lights from the second car to shine the light on the first car so they could help him spread the kerosene on the car. They both got into the Ed Danzerow's car. They went back to the gravel parking lot where their car was parked. They left Ed Danzerow's car there, and then they left in their vehicle, which was the main highway out of town.
Yeah, which makes a lot more sense. I was going to ask, too, was it confirmed that the flammable liquid used to ignite the car, that it was kerosene, or did that just get wedged in because of the kerosene heater at Kit's house?
Okay, so the investigators screwed up. They collected some evidence, but they didn't store it properly that would have allowed them to do a test to positively identify it as kerosene.
Right.
But the lead detective screwed up. He didn't seal it properly. So when it got to the crime lab, they were unable to do a proper test on it. So what they relied on instead was they used the lead investigator at trial who said he smelled kerosene. Then the prosecutor, well, how do you know it was kerosene? Well, I had a kerosene heater when we were kids, and I recognized the smell. So the judge allowed that, and that's how they identified it as kerosene.
And they wanted to identify it as kerosene in order to convict Kit because he had a kerosene heater in his house.
Yeah, and there are some other... There's so many things in this case that I don't know about how you handle wrongful convictions. But for me, there's a couple of goals in handling a wrongful conviction. One is to get the guy who's wrongfully convicted out of prison, right? That's your main goal. But the second goal is to expose the people and hold them accountable to let this happen. And that includes the police, the lead detective, and the prosecutor, the assistant prosecutor, all the way up to the attorney general, who was Andy Beshear at the time. So that's my goal. I want to expose what happened. And through the book and through this podcast, I'm hoping to do that.
Yeah, the same. And ultimately to find out who actually did, because somebody murdered these three people who's walking free.
Absolutely. If Kit didn't do it, somebody else did it, right? And,
right.
And the podcast and the book points to a very plausible, likely alternate perpetrator.
Yeah, and you touched on that a minute ago with the phone in the yard, which we'll circle back to. But I was so, because it was what, 3.5 years after the crime before Kit's arrested, right? It was
yes.
A couple of years. Yeah, 3.5 years.
3.5 years.
But he was originally a suspect because he was facing a court martial. And just to kind of breeze through this a little bit, and I'm sure a lot of this is covered in your book because your book is called I Will Ruin You, which is a quote from Kit's daughter who said that his ex, well, was she his ex-wife? Because she was never really his wife, Joan.
Okay, exactly. She was still married to another man when she mm-hmm. married Kit. So
right.
they found that out afterwards, after they split up and he asked for a divorce. The investigation revealed that she was still married to this other person, which made the marriage null and void, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which really threw a wrench into her plans, because when he asked for a divorce, as you said, her threat was that she was going to ruin his career, his military career, ruin his life, and she knew how to do it. And what she was going to do was accusing him of abuse and child abuse, sexual assault, sexual molestation of her children. She did all of that, including more, right? And the civilian side, it was all dismissed. They didn't have any evidence that he was guilty of any of that. But there were some things on the military side that ultimately led to a court-martial. And the reason why the neighbor was the star witness and not the ex-wife, we'll call her the ex-wife, Joan Harmon was her name, is because she was a liar. She was caught in so many lies that she was not credible as a witness.
Right.
So that's where Calvin came in, because he was ex-military. He was a bit more of a credible witness. But going back to what happened with when they found out that Joan was not legally married and it put a wrench in her plans, that's because she was not entitled to any of his military benefits. She wasn't entitled to his pension. She wasn't even entitled to child support, right? They weren't his kids.
Her spousal support, anything. She couldn't get anything because they were never actually married.
And she's out on the, she's waiting tables somewhere, and she's expecting all of these military benefits to take care of her. And that went all out the window when they prosecuted her for bigamy. So, but she had one more card up her sleeve, and that was she accused him of sexual assault while they were married. So why is that important, right? You're married. How can you charge somebody with sexual assault? Well, she did. She accused him of sexual assault. And the reason is, okay, you don't have to be married to somebody in the military to get benefits from a sexual assault charge. If he's convicted of sexual assault, she was possibly, she could have received up to $250,000 in benefits as being a victim of sexual assault from a military member.
Mm-hmm.
So 2 weeks before the murders, Kidd had hired two private investigators, one worked pro bono, and they went to Calvin Phillips to get some more information. And they recorded all the audio, and I have the audio or excerpts of it in the podcast, where Calvin had said things that were beneficial to Kit. And one of the things was, they asked him, did Joan ever say anything to you about being sexually assaulted? And he said, no. Well, right there, that is evidence that he could have used in the court-martial to challenge the sexual assault charge. And that's part of her motive of why this happened. Because after they confronted him and they recorded the audio without his knowledge, they went to where the restaurant called the L&R Soda Bar where Joan was working, and they secretly recorded her. Well, a day or two after that, those two audio recordings, there was an alleged confrontation between Calvin and Joan at the restaurant. And I've been able to verify it with two different sources. I have one of the sources, well, actually there's three sources, but one of the source, it won't talk to me. And she was there. So she was the only eyewitness to it. The other two are closer to hearsay than actual witnesses. But if it's true that there was this confrontation between the two, 2 weeks before the murders, it very well could have been that Calvin Phillips told her, look, I'm not going to give you any kind of support here. I'm just going to tell them what I know, and that's it. And that could have been the motive right there.
Yeah, and there's a lot to unpack there. One, I want to point out, too, just, you know, as far as sexual assault within a marriage, that certainly can happen, and it does happen. The issue here was there were none of these claims during the marriage. There was none of these claims, even from what I understand, shortly after the marriage. It wasn't until it kind of became the only route, you know, after they're split up, the only possible route for her to get any kind of benefit from this was to make that claim much later.
Absolutely. And it's in the book. It's not in the podcast. But what happened was, you know, they were trying to corroborate all of these claims, right? I mean, she was accusing him of child abuse. Well, do you have any medical records? No, I don't have. She had these images. You probably saw the images.
Yeah.
All right. So she had these images, and she was showing these images all to everybody, emailing the images to anybody that she knew, right, to back up her claim of child abuse. But she never went to the police. She never went to a doctor to have anything verified. So they couldn't corroborate any of that. So they had her in an interview, and they asked her about all these disabuse claims, and she hadn't brought up the sexual assault by then. And they asked her, is there anything else that you can think of that we should be looking at? She said, no, that's it. And then it was after they found out that she was charged for bigamy that she came up with the sexual assault.
Yeah, and that was the issue there. So you have what investigators find when they go into Calvin's house and they start investigating this is he has two subpoenas, and that was a really interesting part that you brought out too. There's two subpoenas on his desk for him to appear in this court martial hearing. One of them is from the prosecution because he's going to be a witness for Jones' case. But the other one was a subpoena from the defense attorney, from Kit's attorney, for him right. to testify as a defense witness, which kind of really throws a kink into the whole, you know, the prosecution's idea that the whole motive here is that he's trying to silence this witness.
Absolutely.
But he was subpoenaing that witness to testify for him.
Right. So, you know, when I first heard about it, you have to wonder, why would you subpoena him since the prosecution already subpoenaed him, right? He was going to be there for the prosecution. Well, what I learned was that just because you receive a subpoena doesn't mean that they're going to call you as a witness.
Right.
Right. So the defense subpoenaed him because if the prosecution didn't call him as a witness because there were rumors and evidence of an alleged affair between Calvin and Joan, all right, mm-hmm. which puts a big damper on his credibility as a witness for the prosecution, right?
Right.
So there was a real possibility that they weren't going to call him as a witness. So that's why the defense subpoenaed him so that he can go in there and get on the stand and say, Joan never said anything about abuse to me. She never said anything about molestation. She never said anything about sexual assault. She never said anything about abusing the children. That's a pretty strong witness.
Yeah. And so it really throws, like you said, a kink into the whole motivation behind the whole thing. And then, as you said, there's these, at least, we'll call them rumors. And I want to make clear, too, my entire look into this case has occurred over today. So I'm not claiming that I know he's innocent or guilty.
Right.
I don't know the case well enough, right? I've only seen, but from what I've seen, because I look at, contrary to what most people think, because I work in wrongful convictions, people think I look at everybody's innocent. It's actually the opposite. I look at everything very skeptically. And so as I start hearing this, I'm like, that's a lot of coincidences. That's a lot of, and then as you start unpacking things, like, why would he subpoena him to make sure he can testify and then kill him so he can't testify?
Right.
And then you have the, you know, this evidence, like I said, we'll call rumor, I guess, at this point.
Well, let me
rumor
stop
about
you there
the,
about being a rumor. All right. There are two witnesses that told a private investigator that they caught them having sex. Right. So
right.
It goes beyond a rumor when you have two eyewitnesses. And
well,
one of them was
he
the chief
sort
of police.
Confirmed it. He sort of kind of confirmed it in the recording you had of the PI talking to him.
Right.
And they said, well, we have evidence that you were having an affair. He said, so what? You know,
right, exactly.
But yeah, the rumor I was referring to is only because it's hearsay from where the sources come from, is that then Calvin, who is, again, just remind everybody, is the witness, the one who was the first one to be murdered, had this confrontation 2 weeks before the murder with Joan at this restaurant. So it seemed like there was some conflict there.
It's time to find furniture that feels like the one. Shop Haverty's Memorial Day sale and save on furniture backed by a regret-free guarantee. Plus, explore fresh styles arriving just in time for summer. Visit Haverty's online or in-store in Columbus at Polaris.
Lots of places can accidentally expose you to identity theft. Doctor's offices, online retailers, insurance companies, the list goes on. Thankfully, LifeLock monitors hundreds of millions of data points a second for threats to your identity, which is way more than anyone can do on their own. LifeLock keeps an eye on your personal information, credit applications, finances, and more. And if they find anything suspicious, like new loans or changes to your financial accounts, they alert you right away. All through text, phone, email, or the LifeLock app. Even better, alerts are automatically activated the moment you become a LifeLock member. No extra work on your part. Get the alerts that could make all the difference. Don't wait. Join LifeLock now. Visit LifeLock.com/iHeart and save up to 30% your first year. That's LifeLock.com/iHeart for 30% off. Terms apply.
Moro Casino. Oh, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Yo, it's Jay Uso from WWE.
And I'm Jimmy Uso.
Chumba Casino and WWE are hyped for the biggest event of the summer, SummerSlam.
I know, I can't wait.
There's nothing better to do while we're waiting
than playing Chumba Casino.
Sign up today and you could win a VIP experience
with Chumba Casino and WWE for SummerSlam.
So what are you waiting for?
Play Chumba Casino and enter for your chance to win.
Let's Chumba. Yeah.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
So just kind of a quick, because I want you guys to listen to get all these details. And I, as one of, this is one of these cases where the more I'm listening, I'm like hooked, and I want to, my investigator hat's on with everything. And Emilio has done a great job of unpacking it all on the show. But essentially they present, well, they've got two pieces of firearm evidence against him. One of them is a shell casing found at the murder scene that it was confirmed by defense and prosecution experts to have come from a gun that Kit owned. And then there's a bullet fragment found in the kitchen of Calvin's house that was a match to a gun that Kit owned. So that starts to look like there's all this evidence there.
Yeah.
But then as you unpack, and on my show, we've dealt with firearm evidence a lot. And as I wasn't shocked at all to hear the bullet fragment had a twist, had a rifling twist on it that is common to pretty much every single 22 caliber pistol that's ever been made.
Right.
It's not his specifically, or there was no like unique markings on it. It was just,
exactly.
There's hundreds of manufacturers and hundreds of thousands of guns that all have that same twist. So that's nothing. And then the 45 caliber on the porch was the real interesting one to me, because it goes to, you know, you called your podcast Framed, is 6 months after the murders, somebody finds this. It was like April. The murders happened in November. So you know, five months-ish.
Mm-hmm.
They find a shell casing for a 45 caliber, and they determine that casing came from one of Kit's guns, which sounds like it's
slam dunk.
You know, smoking gun. That's it.
Yeah.
The problem is they also have the bullets and the bullet fragments from the 45 that were used in the murder, and those bullets didn't come from that casing. So if you're tracking that, they find this casing that just miraculously appears months later, missed by all investigators, and they're like, "Yep, that came from Kit's gun." But then the actual bullets used didn't come from that. So now it goes beyond, oh, that's not strong evidence, to, well, then why? Then how the hell did that casing get there? That bullet wasn't used for the murders, yet the casing's there, and it didn't come. The bullet didn't come out of that casing.
Well, for somebody who only just watched the podcast earlier today, you have absorbed a lot of detailed information because you're spot on, right? Now, the ballistic experts for the prosecution and the defense, neither one of them could exclude the gun because there wasn't enough different, that his gun was the one that was used in the murder, because there were some similarities in the bullet and there were some dissimilarities in the bullet fragments.
Right.
But the biggest tell that this was not, his gun was not used in the murder, was that these were specific special bullets called RIP research, G2 research rounds, all right?
Mm-hmm.
And they had these things on the tip that were called trocars. And they were designed that once it hit the body, these trocars would break up into separate pieces and tear through the body, all right? Yeah. These bullets were designed to kill, all right? So the shell casing that those bullets normally come in, and neither the prosecution nor the defense can find any examples or samples of bullets that had this particular metal match in the shell casing. The prosecution, here's what the prosecution argued, and you've heard the juror because I recorded the juror talking about this particular piece of evidence, is that the manufacturer at some point ran out of their normal shell casings and they used a different shell casing just for this one run. And somehow this one run of these bullets ended up being used in a murder.
You talk about no database anywhere.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So I have to tell you, you know, when I first heard the story and I looked at the evidence, the dog tag evidence, which we didn't talk about, and the shell casing, my first impression was, especially with the dog tag, nobody is that stupid that they're going to leave. It's like leaving your driver's license at the scene of a crime, right?
Right.
A dog tag with your name on it. I said, nobody's going to do that. I mean, even if it's by accident, I mean, he's a major in the Air Force, right? But it was only after I learned of the people that were involved and the people investigating that I realized, yeah, it all makes sense now. You know, to them, they thought this was a brilliant idea. Let's leave this dog tag here, and then to seal the deal, we'll leave this shell casing. They had no clue that the bullet that they actually used to kill these people, or the Calvin Phillips, wasn't the right type of shell casing for that bullet.
Right.
Right?
Yeah, and that the thing I find so fascinating about this case is, as I'm listening to, you know, the evidence, what they're using against him, there were these, and there's a lot of coincidences there, but there always is coincidences in a wrongful conviction. That's how they happen. But the thing that kind of really pointed me towards this as a wrongful conviction actually isn't like so much so that it's like evidence of innocence. It's that it's so obvious evidence of framing. And my listeners know that's not, you know, I'm usually the one that's like, no, the conspiracy theories are, but I mean, this is, so the bullet thing, that was a big one. But then you mentioned the dog tags, and that was the biggest crock, the mental gymnastics. So here's the, and you guys can listen for all the details, but here's kind of the Reader's Digest version of this. They find, like, on a shelf at the murder scene at Calvin's house, a single dog tag on a string that's Kit's dog tag, supposedly. So he was wearing a dog tag. He took it off and set it on the shelf at the murder scene. Does all this to conceal the crime.
Okay, so let me just back up for 1 second about the dog tag, all right? One, it was on a string, which dog tags obviously aren't. And you heard the testimony about it. It had his nickname, which means it wasn't even an official dog tag. It was a novelty item, right? But you should have heard the testimony from Marlene LaRocque, who was on, remember, she was on the phone with Pam before she was murdered, right? Did you see that, where she said that she couldn't find Calvin, but his phone and his wallet were sitting out on the table? Did you see that part?
Yeah.
Okay, so his phone and his wallet are sitting out on the table, but when they find the crime scene the next day, the dog tag is sitting on the shelf next to his phone and wallet. So somebody moved the wallet from the kitchen table to this bookshelf where the dog tag was. Right?
Yeah, or moved it there and put his dog tag there with it.
Right. Right.
Yeah, I would think at the same
scenario,
time.
Right, that happened.
Yeah.
After the murders. They were thinking, wow, this is going to nail his ass. You know, we're going to put this dog tag right next to his wallet. They can't miss it. But police missed it. And they didn't.
Right.
And the family members found it 6 months later.
And as Emilio mentioned, the dog tag. So I was never active duty military, but I was in ROTC in college. So I actually have dog tags. And as I'm listening to this, I'm like, this is such bullshit. It's a single dog tag. It's on a string. As soon as they said, it says Kit on it and not his actual name, and doesn't have his blood type on it. Like, I said, that's not his dog tag. That's not a military issued dog tag. And then the whole thing with it being on a string, and the juror you talked to, bless his heart, my God, he was driving me insane with the mental gymnastics that he was going through to try to me kind of probably justify his own verdict. But it was like, he's like, well, sometimes, you know, helicopter pilot, the state makes this argument that, well, he had it, he switched it over from a chain to a string because he knew he was going to light a fire and chains conduct heat and it would have got too hot on his neck. So he switched it to a string, but then he took it off and then set it down at the crime scene. And I mean, the whole thing, like, it is absolute like that piece of evidence right there is, again, that's not so much, you know, the dog tag there isn't negative, right? It's not evidence of his innocence, but to me, it's positive evidence towards someone is trying to frame him. Someone is going through extreme measures to try to frame him, that they have a fake dog tag made. For those of you that don't know, your military dog tags have your name, your social security number, and your blood type on them, and your religious affiliation.
They didn't have it made specifically to commit this crime, right? It was a novelty item. It was purchased for a teenager. So there's only a very small few amount of teenagers that would have a dog tag with Kit Martin on it.
Well, do we know that? Or did I miss that, or have I not heard it yet?
No, we it doesn't make sense that they would have that much forethought if they were dumb enough to think that leaving a dog tag was going to frame him. Obviously it worked, that they would go out and have a dog tag specifically made for that purpose, right? And especially have it on a string. It makes a lot more sense that this was a novelty item purchased for Jones' son, EJ.
Yeah, I mean, that's a possibility. I don't have any way of knowing, but when did the police miss the dog tag, right? When was the dog tag found?
Like you said, about 6 months later, I think.
About the same time that the bullet was found?
Yeah, I think
the casing.
Well, they handed both items to the police on the same day, right?
Yeah, so I don't necessarily think that it had to be. Well, I mean, it was visible. The string was visible in some of the crime scene photos, right? So it was there.
Right, it was there that day.
Yeah, but I don't. Just from what I know, and I'm certainly no expert in it. I think Kit probably had, if he's as many years as he was in the military, lots and lots of sets of dog tags. I think if he wanted to give Jones Kit a set of dog tags, he would just give him a set of dog tags. I personally think someone did have this. They probably ordered it online, didn't know what they were doing, ordered a set of dog tags for this purpose. That's the only thing. To me, that makes more sense, and it's all speculation, but that makes more sense than it being, you know, that instead of giving him one of his old sets of dog tags, they ordered one that's clearly a novelty.
Yeah, that makes sense, except it would require forethought that these people aren't capable of. That would require a lot of forethought and planning to do something like that.
Well, that's true, but you also have to consider the fact that they had the forethought to leave it there. So it was, to me, that would mean it was part of the plan, whether it was a novelty item or whatever it was. You know, they intentionally put that at the crime scene.
Okay, you remember that the crime occurred at two different times part of the day, right?
Yeah.
Well, that means either they killed Calvin and then they stayed in the house all day until 1 o'clock in the morning, or they killed Calvin and left and then came back before 5:30, right? And they could have left again and come back again later that evening to transfer bodies to the car and move vehicles around and clean up the crime scene and set a fire beneath Calvin Phillips in the basement. And so I think that the idea for framing him came later after this first murder. Because when he was murdered, it was raining like crazy. In fact, the victim, Calvin Phillips, when they found him in the basement, he was wearing a rain poncho and he had the hood of the rain poncho cinched around his head, right? Now, explain to me how Kit, the neighbor, went over to Calvin's house and he found him inside the house wearing a rain poncho. That doesn't make any sense. Okay. Well, he went to his house and told Calvin, come on here, I want to talk to you. And he put his rain poncho on then. That doesn't make any sense. There is another explanation that makes a lot more sense. It's covered in episode 5.
Yeah, and that's a good spot. The last thing that I want to touch on, just real briefly, and don't give it all away. Talk about the phone situation with Joan, about her trying to erase this phone and how all that plays into this.
Okay, so the murders happened on November 18, 2015. On December 31, 2015, New Year's Eve, Joan walks into an AT&T store with her three kids, and she has a phone with her. She's been trying to unlock this phone, and we know that because of what she says. And she goes to the store and says, can you help me unlock this phone? So they take the phone, they take it in back, and then they find out that the phone actually belongs to Pam Phillips, one of the murder victims. So they come back out and they tell Joan that this phone belongs to a murder victim and we've just called the police. So Joan leaves the store with the three kids. As the police arriving to the store to pick up the phone and to view security footage to identify the person who dropped off the phone, Joan calls the detective and she gives him this story that her son, EJ, had found the phone a few days earlier in the front yard next to a tree. So the investigator looks at the security footage. He identifies Joan. And so what do they do as part of their investigation? They do a drive-by of her house. That was it. They didn't pull her phone records. They didn't do a search warrant on her house. They just accepted the story that she found this phone in the front yard. But I don't know if it's covered, if you've gotten to it already or not. The phone location data of that phone proves, see, their theory was he drives Pam's car to the farm field and sets it on fire. Then he walks the 4 miles with the kerosene containers, carrying the kerosene containers at 2:30 in the morning back to the crime scene. He gets into Ed Danzero's car, the neighbor's car. He drives the 20 minutes to where Joan's house is, although he doesn't know where Joan's house is, but according to the prosecution, that's what he does. And he throws the victim's phone into her front yard in an attempt to frame her. Then he drives back and he parks in the gravel parking lot and then he walks home. But the night before closing arguments, and it's covered in episode 5, the defense team argued that, see, he was charged with murder or complicity to commit murder. So the prosecution was relying on this phantom accomplice to explain away all the things that you can't explain away with one person doing it. So they had this all figured out when they got to closing arguments. They want to say, well, he had an accomplice. We haven't identified him yet. We're still investigating the case, but that's how all this happened. Well, the night before, the defense argued to the judge that you cannot argue complicity because they haven't proved that there was an accomplice. So the judge ruled that there was not going to be complicity charges in the jury instruction. So now the prosecution had to explain how Pam's phone was moving in one direction and the defendant's phone was moving in an entirely different direction, almost at the very same time. It's impossible. And they knew it was impossible. So what did they do? They skipped over it and they basically said that he used to work for a cell phone company and he somehow knew how to manipulate cell phone data.
Meanwhile, the actual phone was in Joan's possession that she didn't mention until after she got busted by the cell phone company.
Exactly. And the phone, when the police retrieved the phone, it was wiped clean. All right. And there was testimony given that an iPhone, this particular iPhone anyway, if you tried to unlock it 10 consecutive times in a row, it would revert to factory settings. So let's assume that Joan's story, as implausible as it is true. Her son was outside in the front yard, and he just happened to find this phone, and he brought it to Joan. So we don't know who this phone belongs to, but I'm going to try to get into it, and I'm going to try to, you know, guess what kind of password was used to get into the phone 10 times in a row until I wipe it clean.
Makes a lot of sense. And I think that's a great place to end. We've given away a lot, but there's so much more details. Again, I highly recommend, even if it's on all the audio platforms, by the time you hear this, go watch it on YouTube. There's a ton of, you're going to hear trial testimony, witness interviews, recordings from the PIs, and there's visuals of a lot of the crime scene photos, and it's all stuff. YouTube is the place to watch it. Think of this more of a documentary than a podcast. The documentary series is called Framed, the Kit Martin Story. Again, you can find it on YouTube or on the audio platforms. And our guest here is Emilio Corsetti, who wrote the book, I Will Ruin You, that this is all based off of. And Emilio, I'm glad we connected. The story is super interesting. You did a great job of breaking it down. And I wish you all the success. You did a really good job.
Well, thank you very much.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weber. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kay Wood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X at Truth Justice Pod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney, and Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.
Lots of places can expose you to identity theft. That's why LifeLock monitors hundreds of millions of data points a second for threats to your identity, which is way more than anyone can do on their own. If we find anything suspicious, like new loans or changes to your financial accounts, we alert you right away, all through text, phone, email, or the LifeLock app. Save up to 30% your first year. Visit LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.
Drew McIntyre here from WWE. Wielding the Claymore can be a life of chaos. When I'm not dominating in the ring, Chumba Casino is how this warrior takes a wee break. With hundreds of online social games and new weekly releases, there's always something fresh to try. And those daily boosts, next level. Even my free time feels like Valhalla. So when life feels like a battle, kick up your feet, have some fun, and let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Get a full body reset anywhere you go with Dr. Teal's Magnesium Spray. It's a concentrated magnesium blend of pure Epsom and Dead Sea salts, all bundled up in a convenient on-the-go bottle. A few quick sprays will relax your body and mind and keep you feeling recharged all day long. It's wellness you can feel, and you can find it in your local bath aisle. Dr. Teal's. Yep. You needed that.